If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
This is Words Matter with Norm Ornstein.
We've got the votes and screw the rest of you.
And Dr. Kavita Patel.
These might be some of the smaller moments, you know, with all the bombshells. Didn't catch people's eyes.
Hello and welcome to Words Matter from the DSR Network. Each week, Norm Ornstein and I will talk about the issues facing our country as we head into none other than quite possibly one of the most important election cycles. I say that I feel like every couple of years, but I really mean it this time, Norm. And today, I think we're going to talk about something that's shaping the narrative of not just campuses around the country, Norm, but is it fair to say that what is unfolding across college campuses, universities, and as we're recording this podcast, what's happening on Columbia University's campus, it really does feel like it's just tapping into, like, to use a doctor's kind of phrase here, it's really tapping into a nerve that strikes all of us, whether you are, you know, no matter what your background, racial or ethnic, it feels like everybody is kind of on a heightened, like, sense of, you know, doom or gloom, or if bad things are happening. And as just common citizens, we don't know what to do. But Norm, tell me how you're feeling and what your sense of awareness has been about these issues.
You know, it's really a cascade of emotions of different sorts, Kavita. One part of it, which I think is worth talking about, is the challenge that universities, and especially our most prestigious ones, have, that they have in general navigated horribly over the last decade. One part of it, which of course we saw in a notorious case at Yale a few years ago, is over the whole question of safe spaces for students who feel like they're threatened, quote unquote, or their feelings are hurt. So we know what happened at Yale was that the university had sent around an email to the students and community saying, Halloween is coming up. Please don't wear masks that could be offensive. And in one of their colleges, Silliman College, where they have a faculty, they used to call them masters, the wife of the master, who was also a faculty member there, put out, I can't remember, maybe it was Facebook, saying, come on, you know, this is not appropriate. If people wear something that's offensive, then just tell them it's offensive, but it's not the role of a university to hide people from things that might be offensive. In fact, their role is to have robust dialogue, and free speech is about not about things that are inoffensive. It's about things that could be offensive. And there was a huge uproar, and they basically drummed the couple out of the college. And that was sort of a limiting case of safe spaces. And now we're in exactly the opposite place. And I don't see most of these schools handling this very well at all. And a part of it, there was a really interesting piece by David French in the New York Times, and mostly what David writes, they've, you know, there are, I cringe sometimes at newspapers, the Post being a good example, that tries to get on their op-ed pages people from the right so that they can have the diversity of views. And sometimes they pick just cringeworthy people. The Times chose well with David French. And this was looking at the curricula of some of these universities, including ones that have a core curriculum, which Columbia has. And the core curriculum includes a lot of classic things. You've got to, you know, read Plato. You've got to go back to early philosophers. But what he pointed out, looking at the 20th century and especially the last few decades, is that it's all about colonialism and victims. That's probably a bit of an exaggeration, but that's what frames the viewpoint of students now. And that's why we've seen this enormous backlash against Israel. There was one other piece that I read today that was equally interesting. It was in Newsweek, which is not, I have to say, these days a place I normally look for things, but somebody sent it to me. This was by a Palestinian from Gaza, basically saying that the protesters are hurting that cause. And that's because instead of joining in a wider effort at peace, which would include a much wider range of people who are really upset at what's happened, that by going overboard with go back to Poland, with the Intifada, globalize the Intifada, all of those things, they're creating a much bigger division. In the meantime, you look at campuses from UCLA to Columbia trying to figure out what to do, in some cases vastly overreacting to the tents put up that are peaceful, in some cases not reacting enough when kids, especially including the Jewish kids, are blocked from being able to go to classes when there are direct threats being issued to people. And now, you know, Columbia is just sort of floundering out there. The president, after being berated by Elise Stefanik and others who are simply exploiting this for their own purposes, Elise Stefanik, who's now on the warpath against Holocaust deniers while having said nothing about Donald Trump having lunch with the Nazi Nick Fuentes, but, you know, reacted immediately by having kids arrested in a tent encampment that did not appear to be threatening to anybody. And now, you know, trying to figure out what to do. And now they've got a real problem with kids who have broken windows, broken into a building and occupied it. It's not the first time we've seen that, of course, going back to Vietnam and other times. But, you know, you got to find a way to react to what is clearly over the top and lawless behavior. And in the meantime, the rest of us are out there watching this, and it's really hard to have any kind of dialogue about where we are, what's going on, and what ought to be done about it.
So it's interesting. My husband's an alumnus of Columbia, and so I get the, you know, like whatever the Columbia alumni magazine that goes out like every month. And when President, I just wanted to make sure I pronounced her name correctly, Manoush, I think her name is Manoush Shafiq, President Shafiq, as probably a lot of people have been hearing in the media because there's been a lot of appeals made to her directly. She's, you know, one of the, she was a distinguished economist, just an incredible, like, academic powerhouse, and really kind of noteworthy for being, like, you know, kind of a woman of color, like, you know, recently appointed. This is like a big deal, you know, Columbia University, the historic university. But you and I have talked about just this, like, incredible, this is exactly like what universities need to do, right? The big jobs aren't just for, like, sitting on the endowment and kind of having, you know, cushy dinners, that this is kind of when leadership matters. And you and I have spoken about some of the different responses in the university. It's very disheartening for me to listen. I was probably like you, you know, tune into MSNBC Morning Joe. And they were singing the praises of, like, the University of Florida president, who, like, made it very clear, right? Like, that, you know, anything that stops our students from feeling free to attend, free to learn, was, like, not okay. To your point of, like, whether it's Jewish students or any student, I mean, I can only imagine, like, any, just, you know, think how old they're young adults, that this is something, like, after COVID and everything, like, not necessarily like a welcoming environment to know that, like, a hall, you know, one of the, like, famous buildings is now kind of closed up, and that any minute NYPD could come in. So nobody kind of feels that way. So it's been very interesting to see who someone, she's Egyptian, someone born in Egypt, someone who, like, for all purposes is lauded because of this appointment as the president of a prestigious university. And then the timeline, Norm, like a kind of boom, 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 where things happened just over the last, what is it, weeks, days? This has, like, really, I mean, it started obviously after October 7th with some rallies and, like, you know, what we obviously remember from Harvard, Penn, you know, these hearings that happened in Congress. But literally, like, it's been, I think you're right, like, it's hard to even say what emotion, because there is this kind of combination of kind of angry students who feel very strongly about the Columbia funds being divested that have investments that, you know, kind of create, like, this, like, kind of widening of this chasm in the Middle East. And yet at the same time, and maybe you can comment on what you're reading about, like, some of these more, they're not necessarily student driven. These are, like, kind of professional protesters, if you will. So not necessarily capturing the grassroots of the student voice potentially, but, you know, kind of people who are, like, I don't know how else to say it other than professional protesting, or at least people who are a little bit more experienced to get the crowd going. And you start to not, honestly, Norm, I don't know what's authentic and what's not. And it's hard to discern the two.
Absolutely all of that. And, you know, it's just, it's a painful time. I feel sorry for students at most of these campuses, most of whom are going to miss out on their graduation. They're canceling graduation ceremonies. You know, that's a pretty significant moment in people's lives. If you've been through the 4 years and you're about to graduate, the affirmation that comes from a commencement is pretty cool stuff, and they're going to miss out on it. We've had some just terrible misfires, USC maybe being the worst, you know, canceling the commencement speaker, blaming it on security issues, which was pretty ridiculous, and then canceling just about everything. And you're right, you don't know who's actually a student protester, what outside instigators are doing. It's also pretty disheartening to see some of the rhetoric. You know, the rhetoric has gone from concern about what's happened in Gaza to flat-out overt anti-Semitism for many, about, you know, taking on all Jews, whatever their views may be in many cases. And as the Newsweek piece suggested, that's just absolutely counterproductive if what you want is to end the bloodshed and then begin the process of rebuilding. The other thing, just sort of outside, that's interesting here, of course, is that almost the rest of the entire Arab world is not engaged in this. They're not, you know, calling for terrible sanctions against Israel. Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and others look at this from a different geopolitical standpoint. They want to isolate Iran, and they're ready to cut a deal with Israel and actually begin to have a completely different kind of relationship, a kind of relationship that Hamas tried to blow up. The attack on October 7th was aimed at that. But it also is a testament to another reality. And I have felt this pain for Palestinians for a long time, because the fact is nobody has embraced them over decades and decades. You know, the opportunity to integrate them into societies in Jordan, in other Arab countries, they kept them in refugee camps in Lebanon, Jordan, and elsewhere. They've been abandoned by those who one would think would be their allies. And that was tough even before all of this. And we shouldn't lose sight of another reality, which is the Smotrich and especially Ben-Gavir-driven thugs in settlements who have been, doing attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank, unprovoked, vicious attacks. And at least the U.S. and Biden, to his credit, has begun to put sanctions against some of them. But, you know, it's just it's pretty awful time in that region, but just more generally. And of course, all of this will have an impact on the election.
Yeah. So let's get to that. A couple of things that I thought were worth, you and I on last week's pod highlighted, kind of the nerd prom, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. While we were not in attendance, I think it's fair to say that those who did attend said it was eerily somber, especially at the end of, it's all on C-SPAN, but I'm not ruining some surprise here, but that there was this kind of somber, like, especially tone towards the end. Colin Jost, who was the host, who's a Saturday Night Live comedian, that it was very clear that, like, his story, which was actually quite sweet and quite heartfelt around his grandfather's last vote being for Joe Biden, because he's a decent man, and that's why we need him. He's a decent man. But it was clearly, what was interesting is that both on C-SPAN, you could see this, like, as it was unfolding, but then the people who were in the rooms, that, like, you could hear a pin drop, because it was a very clear moment. Yes, it was compelling, but it was almost as if Colin needed it to be, like, a positive note to end on, because there was this feeling of tension. And I will also add that if you go to some of the, like, Al Jazeera's U.S. Instagram feed and some other news feeds, these are news outlets. These are not, like, random people on TikTok, but news outlets had kind of coverage of the protesters, and they actually had, like, for the members of the White House press corps who are Muslim, kind of identified, like, most visibly by hijab, et cetera, that it was very clear that they were kind of, you know, protesting and booing and kind of calling out those reporters, which is really unfortunate, because first of all, like, when your job is to cover the White House press corps, you know, this is not like you don't take political stances, you cover the White House. And going to the correspondents' dinner it's akin to, you know, it's your job. It's not necessarily like a, you know, you go as part of, like, any association that you're a member. Like, for me to go to, like, my medical association meeting, like, that's, like, kind of my job, and, like, that's where I learn and that's where I see people. It's very unfortunate, but it all points to your comment about the election. Like, tell us, we have a long way to go between now and November, but in some ways between this and, Norm, I want to get your take on this. What occurred to me watching this White House scene unfolding, taking into account this kind of, you know, Colombia, like, what, you know, not just Colombia, but around the country. And then I want to add to that the kind of immigrants that are getting bussed, you know, around the country by Texas and Florida. And then I want to triple onto that, like, kind of this, like, active conversation happening in Washington, D.C. that listeners should know about, with the National Conference of Mayors, where homelessness and immigrants are, like, they're top one and two issues. It's looking a little darker than I would have thought. I don't know, Nora, what do you think? Am I putting too many of these issues all in, like, a big, you know, mess of a pile, that maybe that's not the right way to think about it, but it does feel like it's complicated.
It is, and it's a time to be very nervous. One of the things that Colin Jost said in his monologue at the White House Correspondents' Dinner was, he went through a litany of Trump on trial, all the indictments, sex offender, all of that, and yet the election is a dead heat, and he said nothing makes sense anymore. And there's some truth to that. And as we look at these things, keep in mind that the Supreme Court has many decisions on the docket that will be coming up in coming weeks, one of which is a case that, if they rule in a particular way, would leave homeless people in a even worse state than they are now. It would basically enable governments to ban them from being almost anywhere. And where are they going to go? This is a case from Oregon. It's at least possible that we could see a homeless situation that's pretty nerve-wracking in the country as it is get significantly worse. With that, we also know that Trump and his closest advisors have talked about moving to mass deportation of millions and millions of undocumented people who have been here for years, including bringing out the military and nationalizing a number of red state national guards to put them in the equivalent of concentration camps until they could be deported. Then we have Bill Barr basically acknowledging that at different times in the Trump presidency, Trump had ordered the assassination of rivals, and Barr shrugged it off, saying, well, you know, we didn't do anything, and then he forgot about it, and he wouldn't actually do it. But I'm endorsing him anyhow. So the cult is alive and well. The public is unhappy. We had a deep dive into younger voters, suggesting that more of the potential Biden voters are gravitating towards Robert Kennedy Jr. because when he tells them, make up your own minds, they're going to places that, you know, engage in conspiracy theories or anti-vax. But it's also a lot of young people who don't like Biden and hate Trump. But this may be an outlet for them. Those third party candidacies are a problem. And with what's happening on the campuses, to circle back, it's quite possible that, you know, there'll be a backlash that will continue by young voters, young progressive voters, as well as by the Muslim American community against Biden, even though, and, you know, one of the things pointed out in this Newsweek article was seeing people with rainbow flags railing against Israel and chanting pro Hamas stuff, whether they realize that if that Hamas executed one of its commanders who they suspected of being gay, that the Houthis just executed a number of gay people. You know, you can look at this bizarrely, but it's quite possible that some of them will end up voting for a Trump who will do horrible things to them. So we're in a topsy-turvy, turbulent time, and there's still 6 months to go. But, you know, right now, I don't like the trajectory.
Yeah, none. Yes, that's an understatement. I don't like the trajectory, and I also don't like the... Maybe you can reassure me on this, because I just ties into kind of feelings about the election or in general. Am I just not on X or Twitter enough, Norm, or am I missing... I hear Chuck Schumer, I hear kind of some voices, some clamor. You and I already talked about like the Elise Stefanics of the world, but I don't hear like this would be like kind of back in our day, back in your day, back in my day. This would be when you would see this like strong kind of bipartisan, like, you know, there's just some things that like rally the Senate and the House together. Am I missing this like outcry from, is it just that everybody is taking corners and taking sides and trying to avoid whatever backlash they might get? I mean, I know that Ilhan Omar, like there have been like prominent, you know, Jewish people, others, but I just don't know if I'm hearing anybody else. But are you seeing this vocalized, articulated in a way that's productive on the Sunday shows? I just didn't see anything.
No, I don't see much that's productive out there. And, you know, everybody recognizes that the stakes in the election are high, and this desire to avoid doing anything that might, even if it's the right thing to do, benefit the other side, which is coming most strongly from Trump as he scuttled a border deal that gave them everything pretty much that they wanted. But it's there with just this whole set of issues. They're trying to capitalize on them and drive a wedge between potential Biden supporters and Biden himself. But across the board, and it's partly because there's just no easy answers out there. Now, you know, we're going to have an interesting crossroads ahead on Gaza. Netanyahu is caught right now between two powerful forces. One, on one side, you have Biden and the Biden administration, the families of hostages, a large share of the Israeli population saying, enough already, cut a deal, bring the hostages home. Let's leave it at that, because it's not going to get better. It'll only get worse. The cost of going into Rafah is too high. Netanyahu, not happy with that. But the problem that he has politically is that you've got Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who said if you cut a deal like that, their government collapses. And then, of course, he's going to face jail. A new election, you know, that would be a nice outcome, but who knows what will happen out of all this. And the next, we may not see a resolution of this one way or the other for months, and it could go on until well past the election. And that's not a great thing. And of course, for Netanyahu, as in 2020, as in 2016, he's doing what he can to help Donald Trump. He'd rather have Trump in the White House, because Trump's going to tell him, do whatever you want to do. So all of that's bad. I will mention one other thing, which is, you know, now we're hearing talk about the International Criminal Court going after Netanyahu and some other Israelis. You know, that's one side, but you look at what Russia's been doing, what Russia did the other day, deliberately attacking innocent civilians, wanting to kill as many as possible, and the world shrugs. It's really hard to take.
It is. And I can only say that I can't even imagine like how demoralizing this must feel, or minimizing, demoralizing, all the adjectives. It's very troubling, and it does. I'm gonna try to end us on an optimistic note. It's something you and I occasionally get to touch on, that when it comes down to it, like I think when we talk about some of our favorite members of the House, or just people we respect, you know, whether it's Jamie Raskin or somebody, we talk about just kind of kindness, connections like that. I'm hoping that a little kindness breaks through at some point, because it's a very, this is like one of those moments where you can feel that, like, again, the raw nerve analogy, you feel like something bad is just around the corner. Lots of bad things have already happened, but like even more bad things are around the corner. And it just made me, you know, it just made me kind of think like somewhere in all of this, like somewhere, somehow, like kindness has to break through. I don't know who's going to do it. Maybe it's just you and I trying to like actually live our lives day to day, but it is definitely something that we're having to struggle with, and hopefully listeners will just feel, I don't know if we made anybody feel better, but hopefully people feel less alone. Because if you're feeling confused, that's I think how I wanted to start this with you, Norm. I'm so confused and conflicted, and part of me wanting to, you know, yell at USC, yell at the Columbia president, and yell at these, just nothing seems to be sensible and working. But maybe in all of that, we can find our way towards each other. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we'll follow, obviously listeners will probably follow what's unfolding, not just in New York City, but in cities around the country. And on a bright spot, GW, you know, our neck of the woods, Norm, they've had peaceful protesters. The DC police, chief of police, even had a press conference earlier today or yesterday. I heard the bits of it today, but basically they said everything's very peaceful. People are able to go to classes. The schools, GW has made it very clear that they will suspend anybody that participates in something that inhibits learning, et cetera. And so you're seeing this like kind of, you know, different, not ideal, but certainly seeing like examples of where it feels like people are respecting boundaries, but also honoring in a way like the right to protest and freedom of speech. But I'm not sure how long that'll last either. To your point about the unconscious realization that there are very likely Jewish students who are scared. They're not going to know that they're not going to class because they're not even going to bother. Nobody's going to say like, oh, I didn't attend because I didn't feel comfortable. They're just not going to attend. And so who knows the omission bias, right, that we don't know. And it's just tragic all around. But anyway, all right, that was enough of a rant. I want to thank that it's uncommon for me to end on a nonsensical rant, but I had to because it's one of those moments. I'm going to thank our listeners for joining us. This was more of an emotional catharsis, but that's, I think, what we needed in this moment. And maybe we'll continue the theme. please share this episode if only to just let people know that we're trying to touch on topics that are messy, and the words that we talk about here and the words we talk about from our leaders' mouths matter. We are, if you can become a member, you'll get access to a bonus segment where we're going to do a recap and update on where the Trump trial stands. Words Matter is a production of the DSR Network. Our executive producer is Chris Cottmore, and the producer of our pod is Riley Fessler. The next episode will be in your podcast feeds around, now we'll be in May, around May 6th. See you then.